KBOO is proud to present a live broadcast of the Inner City Blues Festival, a benefit for Healthcare for All Oregon from the North Portland Eagles Lodge, 7611 North Exeter at North Lombard in Portland, Saturday, April 11th from 6 p.m. to midnight. Hear live performances from such local blues and R&B luminaries as LaRonda Steele, Norman Sylvester Band, and many more. Again, that's the Inner City Blues Festival live broadcast and show on Saturday, April 11th from 6 p.m. to midnight. More information is available at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
It's 10:59. You're tuned to KBOO Portland. Coming right up, it's this KBOO Bike Show. Alon and Jocelyn are here as your hosts. This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from City Bikes, a worker-owned, cooperatively run, new and used bicycle sales and service shop with two locations on Southeast Ankeny near KBOO. Open 7 days a week for your bicycle commuting needs and online at citybikes.coop. Also by Hopworks Urban Brewery, committed to creating world-class food and organic beer as sustainably as possible at their carbon-neutral Eco Brew Pubs. Hopworks is located at Southeast 29th and Powell Boulevard, and Hopworks Bike Bar is at North Williams and Shaver, available on draft and in bottles throughout Cascadia. Information at 503-232-HOPS or hopworksbeer.com.
Takes two wheels and no gasoline to keep yourself healthy and to keep the air clean. You can ride in the sunshine, you can ride in the rain. It takes two pedals, two wheels and a chain. Everybody, ride your bicycle.
Good morning, I'm Jocelyn Gowdy, here today with fellow co-host Alon Rabb to welcome you to the April edition of the KBOO Bike Show. We're very glad to have you tuned in. Over the past few years, the concept of Vision Zero has taken center stage in conversations amongst transportation officials and advocates in many American cities. First launched in Sweden in October 1997, Vision Zero is an approach to road safety that is summarized in one simple sentence: no loss of life on our roadways is acceptable. Here in Portland, PBOT Director Leah Treat first announced her commitment to the Vision Zero initiative back in February 2014. In the Portland Progress two-year work plan released by PBOT earlier this year, the organization announced the goal of implementing the strategy and moving toward zero traffic-related fatalities and serious injuries within the next 10 years. Here to discuss Vision Zero today, during the first half of our show, is PBOT Director Leah Treat. She's joined by PBOT Policy, Planning, and Project Group Manager Art Pierce, with whom we'll discuss the progress of the comprehensive plan in the second half of our show. Good morning, Leah.
Good morning.
Thanks so much for joining us here today. I last saw you at the BTA Live the Revolution event, which was to support safe routes to school. And you approached me and asked about coming back to the KBOO Bike Show to discuss Vision Zero. So we're really glad to have you back and to talk about this very important topic.
Thank you. I'm really happy to be here.
Yeah. And the timing is perfect, given that the Oregon Active Transportation Summit happened earlier this week, and you gave a speech about Vision Zero on Monday. So would you like to give an introduction about the speech and what Vision Zero is?
Sure. So as you mentioned, Vision Zero is just started in Sweden. It's a philosophy that loss of life on our roadways is acceptable. It's also a philosophy that traffic deaths are preventable, serious injuries are preventable, and that the government has a commensurate responsibility to ensure people's safety on the roadway and prevent loss of life on the roadway. So Vision Zero is incredibly important to me, and I, as the transportation director, you know, I oversee a very vast network of transportation infrastructure, and that comes with the commensurate responsibility of ensuring people's safe access of that network. But I also come at Vision Zero as a mom. I have four kids that are ages 10 and younger, and I want them to live a really healthy, active lifestyle. I want that for all kids. I want it for everyone. Mm-hmm. And Vision Zero is a part of that, and It was made real for me more so last summer. My son was hit on his bicycle in a crosswalk exiting our neighborhood park. And he's one of the lucky ones. You know, he was hit by a driver traveling at a low speed. Mm-hmm. And he was able to walk away, a little shaken up. He got back on track with the community cycling center and some bike courses. But it's a real issue. And even in a city of Portland, where we have really low fatality rates compared to other dense urban areas, the rate of traffic fatalities is troubling. So
it's an epidemic on American streets. Mm-hmm. I mean, the amount of lives that are lost each and every day.
And one death is too much. Before I ask you a question, sure. This is Alon. I just wanted to wish the listeners that celebrate Easter and Passover happy holidays.
Oh,
and also send a complete and speedy recovery to Tori, who had an unfortunate accident, but is getting stronger as we're speaking and is doing great. So this goal seems worthwhile, and I'm sure each one of us has stories of injuries, deaths. My daughter's first boyfriend, a sweet kid who was working in a pub so he could go to a bike mechanic school in Ashland, was killed when a drunk driver was, you know, going 70 on 20 miles. So it sounds like a goal that we need. We needed it back when cars first started. But what do you plan to do? What are the concrete steps? How do we get to that goal?
So there are many different approaches we're taking. I think, so we're starting four components that we've laid out in Portland Progress that I'll talk about in a little more detail are design, education, enforcement, and
equity, right?
Yeah, mm-hmm. And equity. So I'll start with the education. At the Oregon Active Transportation Summit, I had the pleasure of introducing Paul Steely White, who works for Transportation Alternatives and is critical to the New York City Vision Zero campaign. And I got three really important lessons from him during his speech that I think are really great for us in terms of educating the public in Portland and beyond about Vision Zero. And one is we need to start having conversations about the human life on the roadway. What do we value most? And in every situation in our on our roadway, there's a human involved, whether that human is sitting behind a wheel, they're on foot or on a bike, there's a human factor. And what do we value most? We need to value the human life most, and that means the most vulnerable users. Paul also said that we've put a really positive spin on livability. Everybody likes to put a happy face on things because they think it sells better. And actually, Vision Zero and getting people to care about safety, you have to start talking about death. That's a really sobering word, and it's very burdensome, mm-hmm. right? But, you know, they were very successful in New York. Part of their campaign was because they got survivors,
families.
Mm-hmm. And families and victims to come together, and in their shared grief, they found strength mm-hmm. and came together and lobbied for change. And so talking about death and its impacts is really important.
And putting it in that language is, turns it into a policy that no one can rally against. I mean, everybody has to be, for safety on city streets.
Right. So number three is he talked about we can cure this, right? So we know speed kills and we know how to prevent speed. And we have an epidemic, as you said, on our roadways. We have, on average, every year, more than 35 people dying on our roadways, which is, in most years, more than double the number of homicides in the city. Mm. That's troubling. It's a public safety issue. And if you take the equivalent into the private sector, if you had a doctor or a healthcare professional had come out with a cure for a chronic disease that was able to increase your lifespan for 50% of the population, people would swarm to it. So
absolutely.
Why are they not doing it in roadway deaths?
Mm-hmm.
And to start talking about those issues. Mm-hmm. And so,
When you say start talking, in what kind of forum are you thinking of having this conversation?
So we're having, in many different forums. Everywhere I go, I talk about it. I talk about it with council. I talk about it in the public. I talked about it on Monday. I talk about it here. But, you know, at the bureaucratic level of how we're talking about it and how we're trying to implement it, we are asking the legislature to pass a pilot program in the city of Portland to allow us to have unmanned speed cameras on our high crash corridors. Mm-hmm. That's currently House Bill 2621, and our sponsor is Representative Reardon. We have and the high crash corridors in the city of Portland make up 3% of our roadway network. Just 3%. But can you guess what percentage of fatalities they represent?
Must be more than 80?
No, that's a little high, but it's more than half.
Okay.
So 3% of our roadway network is more than half of our fatalities, and we need to have better tools to help protect the users on that roadway. And unmanned speed cameras is one of them. So currently, the police can issue photo radar tickets, but a police officer has to be standing by the vehicle, manning the photo radar gun, and they can only stay at one location for 4 hours. And there's very limited resources to do this. So it would give us the ability to pilot unmanned speed cameras at fixed locations in our high crash corridors. So I urge everyone to call their House representative and ask them to support House Bill 2621. We're also trying to get the speed limits lowered on our high crash corridors and other corridors throughout the city. We recently made an application to ODOT Speed Control Board and got the speeds lowered from 35 to 30 on Southeast Division in Burnside. And recently we put in an application to the Speed Control Board for blanket authority to set the speed limits on the roadways in the city of Portland. And I'm hopeful that they will approve it.
And so we're talking a lot about speed right now. Why is that such an important factor to seeing Vision Zero be a success?
Speed kills. There is a hockey stick of death between a car traveling at 20 miles an hour and 40 miles an hour. So if you're a pedestrian and you are hit by a car at 20 miles an hour, you have a 90% chance of surviving that crash. If that same car hits you at 40 miles an hour, your chances of survival drop to 15%. So speed kills.
Yeah, and that's not a very, I mean, that's a fairly small window that
it's
we're working
really
with.
Really small window. Mm-hmm.
So let's touch back on the speed cameras real quick, because I've heard some chatter about that. How will the, are they secret cameras? Are people going to know that they're there? How will that work? And how is that, how do you envision it changing people's the way that they drive on those streets?
And do you, are there any concerns about civil rights and government spying?
These are all great questions. And the goal of the program is to change behavior, not issue tickets.
Mm-hmm.
So there will be adequate signage along the corridor alerting drivers where speed cameras are located. We will issue warnings before we issue citations. Mm-hmm. It'll be followed by an education campaign. But something that I would love to talk about that I'm welcome to people's input on is the unfortunate thing is the majority of our roadway deaths are happening in communities of color and lower incomes. So I don't have the answers, but we really need to be cognizant of the social justice issues that this will present when we move forward.
Well, like what specifically?
Well, we are looking at putting the unmanned cameras on the high crash corridors. Mm-hmm. And so people who would be potentially receiving those tickets are people of lower income and people of color.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't want to negatively impact the communities in which we're trying mm-hmm. to.
What other cities have implemented speed cameras and have they seen success with them?
Yes. Mm-hmm. So other countries have internationally. They're very successful. We implemented speed cameras in Washington, D.C. when I worked there. The program's been in effect for well over 5 years, and they've seen overall more than a 20% reduction in fatalities. In Chicago, where I worked, we implemented a speed camera program around parks and schools, and in the first year of implementation, there was an 80% drop.
That's a significant number, something to pay attention to.
Yeah. Sure.
And it seems like those cities you mentioned and places also have protected bikeways. How do those fit into the plan here?
We are, everyone knows humans are fallible. And the more physical barriers that you can put between the users, the safer they are. It's unfortunate that we lack funding for a lot of these physical separations in our network, and it's something that we are constantly seeking through grants, through partnerships. Mm-hmm. But separating users is a proven safety measure.
Funding, does it come from the state, or do you work with the federal government, and what's happening in Congress right now? I didn't mean to depress you so early in the day, but...
I sent out a depressing email yesterday about that very matter at Congress. We get our funding from all sorts of different sources. So, yeah, it comes from the federal government, it comes from the state, it comes from the region, it comes from local sources, state sources. What's going on in Congress is really unfortunate. Our existing transportation authorization bill is going to set to expire at the end of May unless Congress acts to extend it. And currently there's no agreement. So the Senate and the House have put forth bills that would drastically reduce the transportation funding, which means a reduction in the amount of funding that's going to come to the states. And they're also trying to change the policy formulas by which funding gets allocated. So there's different buckets of mm-hmm. safety, of maintenance and bridges. And where the tweaks are happening in the policy area are really affecting the flexible funds that come to urban areas to do the kind of roadway reconfigurations and safety improvements that we need to make. So if Congress doesn't act, I don't know what we'll do. You know, ODOT has told us that they probably can float us for about 6 months of reimbursements on our federal program, but then you know, we lack local money as well. Everybody who's listening is probably very well aware of the Our Streets initiative and how that went. So we're really starved for funding.
And as Representative Blumenauer, who's been fantastic for bicycles, has he been active on this issue?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Representative Blumenauer last year introduced legislation to raise the gas tax by, I think, 15 cents. He's been an outspoken advocate and leading the forefront of this. He's tremendous.
I mean, is Vision Zero something that they're talking about at the federal level? Because, I mean, we talked, Sweden as a nation introduced it as a national policy. And then at this point, it's like individual American cities are kind of picking up on it. But when's the entire country going to get on board?
Right. Thank you for that question, because it reminds me that Congressman Blumenauer, along with Representative Buchanan, I believe, mm-hmm. introduced joint legislation to fund Vision Zero programs mm-hmm. at the federal level to create a pot of money that cities could apply for to implement Vision Zero programs. So he's really trying to take it nationwide mm-hmm. and has been an outspoken advocate for us.
Is there any opposition from car manufacturers, gas companies? I mean, is to the zero plan, or is everyone saying this is a great idea?
No, we've actually had some interesting partnerships that you know, if you start thinking about it, they make sense. But we've got AARP is on board. Mm-hmm. And actually, you know, car manufacturers are on board. I was just telling somebody the other day, I learned that Volvo is committed to Vision Zero. They want by 2035, no one to die in a Volvo car. So they're implementing technological improvements to their vehicles to help protect the drivers from their own mistakes mm-hmm. that any of us could make.
And that's interesting, right? Because Volvo headquartered in Sweden. And what I've read kind of seems like the government puts forth the initiative, educates the population on it, and then the population starts to respond and demand safety. And more than just on their streets and their vehicles. And then so Volvo, a company that's based there, responds to their customer demands and starts to implement more safety technology into their vehicles, which I mean, that's just a nice loop, the way that works together.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
Great. Well, speaking of other advocacy groups that are joining this conversation, you know, the BTA and Oregon Walks presented their plan this week. So how does PBOT intend to work with those groups to on Vision Zero?
Yeah, really, it's great to see BTA launch their plan, because they're a statewide advocacy mm-hmm. organization, and Vision Zero needs to be adopted statewide, and advocacy efforts with our legislature and people who make decisions about where state funding goes mm-hmm. Is really important, and the BTA is picking up the mantle on that. So I'm excited to work with them and support their advocacy efforts. And our Vision Zero campaign is really focused on the city of Portland, because mm-hmm. that's where our resources go. So we're happy to partner with them and help them in their advocacy efforts for funding at the statewide level that hopefully Portland will benefit from, but we really want to see this take off statewide.
Absolutely.
Can you talk a little bit about neighborhood greenways? And maybe another related issue is paving of roads. Some cyclists complain that it seems like the roads that are actually in good shape are the ones repaved. And I could think, I live in Northwest Portland, a bridge over the McClay Park was in terrible shape for years. It was, you know, full of potholes. If you rode a bike on it, as I do every day, it was quite a challenge sometimes. So is that a misconception that we have, or?
Yes. And it's a really understandable one, because visually the roads don't look bad, but you can't see what's underneath that top layer of asphalt. So because of our limited resources, we have focused our work on three areas. So the arterials, where the main movement of goods is happening, on neighborhood greenways and around schools and parks. And where you see maintenance occurring is where the roads are in good condition, but they're about to slip into poor condition. And if we do preventative maintenance on them, they will stay in good condition for 5 to 7 years longer. So it's a better bang for our buck. Mm-hmm. The roads that are in really, really bad shape that need to be completely rebuilt cost on average more than $1 million per lane mile. And we just don't have the funds to address them right now. But we are prioritizing neighborhood greenways. And we recognize that a smooth ride for a car or a bicycle is safe and pleasurable. So we want that for.
And for those that are not familiar with that concept, what is a neighborhood greenway?
The neighborhood greenways are, gosh, I just ride them every day. I've never thought about describing them. They're low-stress neighborhood streets that are cut off pretty much from turns from the main arterials that go through them, and they've got lower posted speed limits, roughly, I think, 20 miles an hour on neighborhood greenways. Thanks, Art's giving me a nod, yes. And
how many miles do we have of greenways now in Portland? Oh, I stumped you.
You did. You did. So, but that's
quite
okay.
a few.
But we just, you know, I haven't gone through it in detail, but we just finished some research on our neighborhood greenways, and it was presented at the Active Transportation Summit. We have a report about the condition of our of all the greenways, and where we're seeing trouble spots where we've got cars exceeding desired counts on those roads. And so we have data in front of us now to put a plan forward on how to keep our greenways, neighborhood greenways, because we're hearing from a lot of people about the stressful environment that of car traffic, of people diverting because of congestion onto neighborhood greenways.
And it's an environment where cyclists and pedestrians would expect it to be a very relaxed ride, where those things, those interactions aren't going to occur.
Right,
so.
Yeah.
Well, you hinted at making a plan. So next steps here, both for this neighborhood greenways and for Vision Zero, where do we go? How are we going to see PBOT begin the process of initiating Vision Zero in Portland?
So the things that I talked about with House Bill 2621, enforcement, education, outreach, street design. I think 2016 Foster is coming on board. That's part of our Vision Zero initiative. We're going to take the four-lane arterial down to a three-lane roadway with a center turn lane. You're going to see we've got 20 more rapid flashing beacons and crosswalk improvements going in East Portland. So these are the real measurable things that are happening on the implementation. We're going to continue to fund safe routes to school, crosswalk enforcement actions. We continue to do those on a regular basis. Mm-hmm. And those are really all about education.
Mm-hmm.
So,
and how can we as users that are out on the streets and engaging with other users, how can we have conversations that are valuable to help further that education initiative, be it amongst our fellow cyclists or to drivers? Should we have a close call? Any recommendations on how we can talk amongst ourselves?
I go back to what Paul Seeley White was saying about the value of a human life.
Mm-hmm.
And this city is growing. It's experiencing growing pains, and the tensions between and our roadway network are likely going to increase. And unless we learn how to move together, if that makes sense, we need to come at it from that perspective, that this isn't a zero-sum game for any mode. Mm-hmm. And we all need to share the roadway network. And you being on a bicycle frees up one more, you know, that's one less car on the road. Mm-hmm. There's plenty of data that supports that signalized intersections with lower speeds actually move traffic faster. So slowing down actually doesn't cause congestion if you have the right engineering behind it. So there's people are more worried about their 3-minute commute time being, you know, adding on 3 minutes to their commute than saving a human life. And I think we need to flip that script into it's okay to be 3 minutes late to work so somebody else is safe.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, are there any plans for 82nd Avenue? And also, for personal reasons, I'll ask about Southwest 14th that I sometimes ride on. And around Everett, there's a turn, you know, cars come from the freeway. A few people were killed over there over the years, injured. It's something that I don't know. I think something should be done and soon.
Art, you want to take this one?
Sure, I'll jump in. So Art Pierce here. So in terms of 82nd, we're in a process right now, a planning process with ODOT, looking at 82nd and kind of envisioning what the future of 82nd would look like. So that's a very active conversation going on with them and a number of community groups. The 82nd Avenue Coalition is really helping to drive that conversation. So I don't think we know the outcome of it yet, but we're getting very good participation about discussions around 82nd. ODOT is investing in the near term in some more signalized crossings, so they are sort of doing some near-term fixes that will sort of help regardless of that long-term vision. Mm-hmm. In terms of the intersections and the connections with I-405, I think the other piece you brought up, that really relates mostly to the Central City Project, which I'm happy to talk about probably later in the second half of the show.
Yep,
I think that's
absolutely.
Coming.
Yeah. Great. Well, actually, on that note, let's go ahead and take a brief break, and we'll come back in the second half of the show and dig into the comprehensive plan with Art. Yep. Thanks so much. You are listening to the KBOO Bike Show here on KBOO 90.7 in Portland, on the web at kboo.fm. Please stay with us for the second half of our show when we continue our conversation with Leah Treat and Art Pierce about the future of Portland streets. Don't touch that dial.
Pedals, two wheels and a chain. Everybody, ride your bicycle. Let's get together and leave our cars home. Everybody, get on your bicycle. Let's get together to pedal and roam. You can take a ride up in Forest Park. You can ride with the light if you ride in the dark. You can ride from the mountain down to the beach. You can ride on a trail. You can ride in the street. You can ride through a puddle, you can ride in the rain. You can take it on a bus, you can take it on a train. Take a ride through the waterfront or down from the zoo. You can take a ride anywhere you want to. Everybody, ride your bicycle. Let's get together and leave our cars home. Everybody, get on your bicycle, let's get together to pedal and roam. It doesn't matter if you're big or small. You can take a ride to work, you can ride to the mall. Just keep the sky up above and the ground underneath. Some wind in your hair and some bugs in your teeth. Everybody, ride your bicycle. Let's get together and leave our cars home. Everybody, get on your bicycle. Let's get together to pedal and roam. Everybody, ride your bicycle. Let's get together. Let's get together to pedal and roam.
Hello, and welcome back to the second half of the KBOO Bike Show. I'm Jocelyn Gowdy here with Alon Robb and joined by our guests Leah Treat and Art Pierce. So we're going to change the conversation away from Vision Zero and start talking about the Portland's comprehensive plan. And Art Pierce, I'd love to hear more from you on how the plan is progressing, how it fits in and works collaboratively with the other plans on the table, the Transportation Systems Plan, also known as the TSP, and the Portland Progress Plan, which we've been discussing. That's the plan that includes Vision Zero.
Great. Okay. I think one of the things maybe to start with, just a lot of people ask, how is PBOT structured and how do I fit within the machine? One of the things that's been really great that Leah has done since becoming the director is she's made some organizational shifts that really strengthen the effectiveness of the organization. So one of the things that she's done is cluster together policy planning, project planning, the project delivery staff, as well as active transportation into one team. Those were in three different parts of the organization previously. And that really helps us to be more guided by policy and more strongly deliver on projects that are essentially grounded in that policy vision that comes from the comp plan and the transportation system plan. So I think it's a very effective organizational shift that I think leads into this conversation in terms of how we're moving along. So I'm the manager of those teams together, and we call it policy planning and projects.
How many folks are we talking about?
There's 52, I think.
It's a good-sized team.
Yeah. And so it's a lot of the programs that many of the listeners know and love in terms of Safe Routes to School, mm-hmm. In terms of Sunday Parkways, Smart Trips, as well as the folks that are building big, large projects in various parts of the city. So it's a wide range of staff.
And everyone's working together now. Everybody kind of is under the one group and sharing ideas and conversations.
Absolutely. And actually, one of the other sort of exciting evolutions, I think, that will be, it's ironically going to be signed today as April Fool's, right? But it's not actually April Fool's, is that we have a joint letter coming from all three modal committees. So we have a freight modal committee, a mm-hmm. pedestrian modal committee, and a bicycle modal committee, all jointly signing on to letters of support around changes in the TSP. And so that's a great evolution that I think is a first for the agency, or at least in my memory. So I think that's also demonstrating what we're starting to show with effectiveness.
Congratulations.
Yeah, thanks. It's exciting.
And the TSP, that's the Transportation Systems Project, correct?
Absolutely. So let's back up a little bit. Mm-hmm. So the two big conversations that are going on now that hopefully your listeners are tracking, and if they're not, hopefully they will. We are updating the city's comprehensive plan, both because it's required by the state, but also it's timely to sort of update our vision for the city. It's been nearly 20 years since we've done that effort. Mm-hmm. And this is both a land use plan and a transportation plan for the city. So it's really laying out the vision for what the city that we want to live in and look in and what the city looks like.
Where people live, where people work, how they get in between and do everything else.
You got it. And mm-hmm. one of the key parts that I think has been central to Portland's success historically, and I think will continue to be that, is the beginning of your transportation strategy really is a land use strategy. If you're able to make places where people don't need to travel as far or rely on an automobile just to safely get to the nearby grocery store, mm-hmm. we're creating a system that can be more balanced over time, healthier over time, and more prosperous.
And then you're talking about zoning when you're talking about that. Is that correct?
You know, it's zoning. It's also, yes, zoning is part of it. Also is how we put our infrastructure in to encourage development.
Okay.
You know, so for instance, emphasizing streetscape improvements along a street like Foster that Leah referenced is an intentional investment by the public to reinforce a place to happen. Mm-hmm. And so every time we spend public dollars, we should be thinking, you know, cognitively about what is the place we're creating by that investment.
Mm-hmm. So the older plan, if I'm not mistaken, spoke about by 2035 reducing the number of miles that people travel by car to maybe 11 miles a day, having neighborhoods where 90% of the residents can easily walk or bicycle. Are those goals being changed in light of the tremendous number of people moving into the city?
Really, no. Those are being reemphasized even stronger. You know, so a lot of those goals came out of the Portland Plan. Mm-hmm. And so the Portland Plan really serves as the guiding document for the Comprehensive Plan update and the Transportation System Plan update. So those are policy directions that then staff are now and the Planning and Sustainability Commission are now incorporating into this next update.
And how do those plans relate to? There's also a Climate Action Plan.
There is.
Yes, there's so many plans, and I'm glad you didn't use acronyms only to describe them. But
trying not to, yes.
Is there a conflict between that goal and the transportation goal?
Really, the climate action plan, because it's focused on responding to climate change, goes beyond what is the sort of core need to deliver services for the system. And so it's actually pushing us probably farther than what is the sort of base construct of having a transportation system that works. It's leading us to reinforcing climate outcomes as well. But so it's a strong influence on the investment strategy. One of the things within the transportation system plan, so the transportation system plan itself asserts policy direction, and we're updating the language in the policy direction to match up with the land use vision. So the transportation investment strategy and policy direction, match
everyone's
up together.
Speaking the same language.
Everyone's speaking the same language. Mm-hmm. And then there's an investment strategy, which is where do we put the public dollars to help reinforce that outcome that we want to see. And one of the new processes that we initiated this time is to use a whole series of criteria to look at our investment choices and align those with those policy directions. And so climate and equity and safety were all sort of new influences that maybe before was embedded in the planner's mind, but hadn't been explicitly stated as something that we're trying
goals
to further, right?
Mm-hmm. Great. Yeah. Oh, and then, so back to the comprehensive plan specifically. Yeah. Where are we in the progress of that plan being accepted as our approach? This is what we're working on now.
You bet. So the process for the comprehensive plan and at least portions of the transportation system plan are before the Planning and Sustainability Commission right now. And mm-hmm. so the official public comment period closed on March 13th, but there's a whole series of conversations that will continue, both the Planning and Sustainability Commission itself as it wrestles with feedback and the policy directions, as well as it moves towards City Council. And so I think for listeners who want to have influence on this, track that process as it moves forward so that they can be present at City Council and testify at City Council to make sure that they're reinforcing the elements that they like, hopefully, about the plan, but also mm-hmm. elements that they think need to be improved. There's sort of an iterative process where the recommendation becomes the recommendation of the Planning and Sustainability Commission, and certainly we know that there'll be testimony in all directions going to City Council that we really need to make sure that your listeners are represented in that community.
Okay, and so what do we have dates announced?
We don't have dates yet. So the at least I don't have in my head. Mm-hmm. The process will be heading through City Council this summer and into the fall.
Okay.
So that's really the timeline for people to keep track of. I think we expect a recommendation coming for many of the elements coming out of the Planning and Sustainability Commission in May. So it's heading through at that time. There's certainly our implementation level elements that will be continuing on beyond this year and into next year as well.
Okay.
And when you mention equity, what do you mean specifically? What's your goal and how do we get to that?
When we looked at equity with our investment strategy, we've got from the Portland plan a broad directive to incorporate equity in the work, and actually it's reinforced in Portland Progress, the PBOT's 2-year plan as well. We're looking at sort of equal access to opportunity and improving that opportunity. And so when we're evaluating investment decisions, we're looking at disadvantaged communities specifically and making sure that our investments are supporting their access to opportunity. So looking at areas of high populations of youth, seniors, and minority populations as place to target our investment to make sure that we're supporting their access to opportunity, their safe sidewalk networks, their connections to transit, those kind of elements.
Great. And the central city, there's a aspect of the comprehensive plan that deals with that directly.
Right. So this is why it is often so confusing for people to figure out how to navigate.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time as we're updating the comprehensive plan, we're also updating the central city plan. So there's a central city 2035 plan that at this point is working its way through the quadrants. So the west quadrant went to City Council a couple weeks ago, I believe. And the Northeast Quadrant has already gone to City Council a year ago. The conversation that's most active right now is the Southeast Quadrant, so the Central East Side. So from Burnside, or from 84 really, south to Powell, that section of the Central City. There's a meeting this Thursday night of that committee, and I believe it's at Portland Opera, but I should have checked before I said that. So, but we can give you more information for that. So, and that is really looking at both that land use vision for the district as well as the transportation investment. And that's a key area, I think, that many people are aware of how much it's both changing in terms of new players coming to the area, but also how important it is to reinforce and support our industrial character, really, of the area that's surrounding this radio studio here.
Yeah. We're the vast majority of folks who live in Portland go to work. Right. So it's really, really valuable. Is there anything that you can tell us specifically about cycling infrastructure that might be incorporated in this
city? There's sort of broadly, there's a series of potential routes for improved infrastructure. So on the Central East Side, looking at how to improve a neighborhood greenway or cycleway like Salmon, for instance, which gets you sort of to the Central East Side, and then you have to kind of figure it out as you go to get the rest of the way down to the bridge. So those kind of sort of small improvements.
Signage and that sort of thing?
Signage, but also signalization across. MLK and Grand is really the major barrier, in my opinion, on the Salmon Street.
Those can be tough streets to get over.
Tough streets to cross and find a gap at crossing all those elements. So those are the kind of investments that we are, you know, are pretty sure we need to make to support the district. Other conversations that many people are tracking is we did get federal funding for the Central City Multimodal Project. Mm-hmm. And so that's one that we have a $6 million grant to pursue essentially a whole series of investments around the Central City. I think many of them will happen in the west side, the downtown portion of the Central City. But that's one that we're ramping up right now. We're actually interviewing and hiring a new project manager to take that project on. So that's a very senior level project manager, because it's a very important project. Mm-hmm.
In multimodal, it's going to speak to both the vehicles down there and the bus and light rail and bicycles and pedestrians.
The West Quadrant plan itself and the whole Central City plan will give us the context to understand the whole package of investments that needs to happen over time to support the district's, you know, the whole Central City's prosperity. So there will be need for transit improvements. There'll be need for signalization improvements and safety improvements really across modes. The grant specifically is really emphasizing mostly pedestrian and bicycle infrastructure. And so that's where, for instance, your question earlier around 14th, around 405, that's where I would expect some solutions to that type of challenging area to come out of that funding stream over the course of the next couple of years.
And if I recall, there was also some discussion about putting a bike lane on Southwest 12th, and there was some opposition from businesses, and that sort of fell through. I'm interested in those kind of political forces that operate. And also another question related to it is, on the site Portland Transport, I read an article by Garland Woodsong, who is a neighborhood planner, I believe.
Sure. Yeah, I know him.
And he quotes Roger Geller, head of the city's bicycle program, and I was surprised to see that Roger saying this. Portland's bicycle network is largely substandard and incomplete. Most of that 250% growth in bicycling since 1994 occurred in the face of bicycle facilities now recognized as inadequate for most people, that failed to match best practices, et cetera, et cetera. I was thinking, who wrote this? Is this Roger Geller I know?
I'm not actually not surprised to hear Roger say that. Roger is really a great leader within, you know, our system of pushing us to do better, and really connected with the, you know, the international bar that we are, you know, striving as the city of Portland to be part of.
And often compared to, right?
But so, do you agree with this statement? Or do you think he was... had a bad day?
I think this is part of Roger's role. So as the bicycle coordinator, you know, he's integrating bicycle improvements and the priority for cycling improvements into the policy work that we do and also in the project work we do. And so he's helping to give us a nudge in the process to make sure that we are not feeling like we've done enough and that we are striving to do better. I think particularly if you're looking into the future, you know, looking into what the transportation system plan and the comp plan is looking towards, I think we can say with certainty that we don't have an adequate system to get to that finish line. We're not there in terms of the level and character of the system we need in terms of protected bicycle facilities. Without those, we will not have enough people feeling safe and comfortable to meet our mode share goals and have a balanced system. So we know that we need to have more systems. For instance, for me, with my eight-year-old son or with my mom when she's visiting, there isn't a system where I feel like I can navigate the whole system. Mm-hmm. with someone who's younger. My wife and I, we can go out on a date by bicycle and feel comfortable, but we can't take the rest of our family. And that, to me, that's a clear sign of a deficiency over time.
Yeah. But I think it's important to remember where we were 10 years ago or 15 years ago.
Sure. Yeah.
Even though 100 years ago, Portland had a great bicycle system and a lot of activity. And also look at other places. I've lived in Eugene, Berkeley, Davis, and Portland, and it's been great to cycle, but recently I was also in Phoenix and Las Vegas, and it's a different world. I mean, not only because people never heard about climate change or evolution, but, so Portland has done well.
Portland really has done well, and I think that's, part of that is due to leadership from city staff, like people like Roger, and a lot of it, though, is the community that we've developed here in Portland and the way that we, as a group, influence the system and understand the importance. I'm always surprised by the number of conversations I overhear at a pub where people are explaining to each other important policy decisions, and it's sort of, I smile to myself, wow, people are actually understand this as a community, not just as a set of staff. And that's, I think, a real tribute to why we've been successful.
I had a Portlandia moment this weekend when I was picking up some dirt to fill in our garden beds and just having a conversation with the woman whose house we were at. And transportation came up on topic. And she knew so much more than I would ever expect anybody. Right. I mean, we were just picking up dirt from her house, and we got into like a fairly robust conversation about alternative transportation, which I think is the reason why people moved to Portland. It's certainly the reason why I moved here. So I really like that we have such an engaged, you have an engaged consistency.
And certainly someone, I've worked for the city since 98, and so I've worked for many years trying to produce great new projects. It never has happened in my experience where it is only led by city staff and only led by city leaderships. When people talk about needing leadership to see change happens, a lot of it has to come from the community side and from within our community systems. It never works, in my experience, to have it just coming from just the city side. And one of the key players that we need to make sure is understanding this is the business community. That's one of the things that, everyone who's listening to this right now, I assume, is at work or is heading to work later today, or, really need to be talking to our employers about the importance of good cycling infrastructure and having a system that works.
All right, I actually saw you a few weeks ago at a bike business happy hour at Elemental. Yeah. Are additional events like that scheduled? How are you reaching out to the business community?
That's a great question. So we are partnering a lot with BTA on that approach. That was the first, and honestly, BTA probably was a little ahead of us on that one in that they scheduled it before we were sort of fully ready to understand how we wanted to frame those conversations. So we've talked more with Garrick about doing more of those in the coming months. Mm-hmm. And I think they're a great way of teeing up the conversation before we're specifically about the Central City Investment Project, because we need to have not just cyclists paying attention to this conversation. It's really important to the prosperity of our downtown and to the way the system needs to function over time. And so we have to spread the conversation so that there's leadership who don't cycle understanding the importance of this investment.
Mm-hmm. Where does the urban boundary come into play here? Are there... Because it seems to me that over the years, we have it, we're proud of it, but it seems to me that every few years they expanded a little more. And if you look at it over time, it's a great expansion. And the other thing maybe related to it is another painful subject, the bridge over the Columbia.
Oh, right.
Yeah. So I hate to be the voice of negativity today, but...
right. I'll start with the UGB because that's an easier one. So the urban growth boundary, I think, is hopefully people, this is one of the things you often hear people talking about on the train. So I think it's something that people are generally familiar with, but that is essentially a growth limit on our region. So not just on Portland, but the whole region. And one of its great benefits is it produces sort of more pressure on us to think more intentionally about the space we have. So rather than thinking about limitless resources and limitless growth potential, we're thinking about we don't have enough space to proceed that way. We need to be more intentional and more thoughtful. And that comes into play in terms of people investing more heavily in their sites, so building more aggressively on a site, including more people there. But it also comes into how we use our right-of-way system. I'd say that the challenge regionally is, I think, us understanding the way that our choices influence the suburban communities that are on the edge of the UGB, and also their understanding how their choices influence us. So in terms of out in Aloha or somewhere like that, you know, if they're not building a complete system there, their residents are going to be relying on the automobile and aren't going to have a choice but to drive through downtown Portland or drive to downtown Portland. And so that choice starting way out at a suburban area has an influence on how well our system can function. And so that's really where the urban growth boundary ties us together to understand that connectedness. And at Metro, there's plenty of conversations through the Joint Policy Advisory Committee about how to manage that system and to share that investment.
And the bridge?
So the bridge was one, you know, is a very challenging conversation. There is a huge amount of congestion and deficiency at that location. Mm-hmm. The solution that I think that we got to within that process probably wasn't the right one. And so, but it doesn't mean that we shouldn't do something to fix that area. There are smaller investments that probably need to be made in that area. And that's a bigger challenge that we need to figure out. And it's not one that I think is an active conversation. In fact, the Planning and Sustainability Commission, I think, will need to, together with its regional partners, talk about what that long-term vision will be for that investment strategy. So.
More plans on the table.
More plans on the table. Right.
Well, let's spend the last 5 minutes or so chatting about the Oregon Active Transportation Summit that happened this week. I wasn't able to attend, but I'm really interested to know just kind of a wrap up. You know, what kind of conversations were happening there? What was bubbling to the surface as really exciting topics? We had people from all over the country coming to here to our city to take notes and then take back to their own communities. So kind of interested to hear what that experience was like.
At least a couple things that was very strongly reinforced, and certainly through the plenary topics, a focus in on safety and Vision Zero, mm-hmm. very, very strongly, both in the plenary and through sessions throughout the day. Also, I think a continued emphasis on equity. And it's becoming more than just a buzzword, which is great. People are trying to think about how to operationalize those choices and how to understand when there's a choice, you know, how equity is factored into that. And so I think that was really encouraging to see.
The keynote speaker spoke on
The lunchtime keynote. Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so she did a great job with.
Remind me her name. I've forgotten.
Melissa
Wells.
Oh, Melissa. Sorry. From Policy Link.
Yeah.
She's from DC.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And she did a great job.
I heard she did wonderfully.
Yeah, she really was. Yep. She was terrific. So it was great to bring those outside perspectives here. It also, I think it's always encouraging and exciting when we hear sort of national conversations, national speakers coming, reinforcing something that we're sort of currently grappling with, to reinforce that we are taking on something that's meaningful and worthwhile. Mm-hmm. A lot of the other topics, that there's everything from, there was a tour of great bike parking facilities yesterday. I mean, it's amazing the things that people really are interested in, right? People are doing this for their living, and they really want to know what is it that Portland has done really well, mm-hmm. And how can they take that back to their cities? So.
Very good.
And what about you, Leah? What did you hear at the conference that you liked?
I attended the Paul Seeley White, which I've talked about. I thought was the most biggest learning moments for me. And then I attended a session on how to implement Vision Zero in your region or in your locality. And so we were split up into different groups, and we talked about what were the barriers to implementation, who did we need to engage to make Vision Zero happen, how would we see it, what would outcomes look like, how do we get people to surround the issue and make it be community-driven. And so it was really a great moment for me to learn how to engage the community and get people excited about Vision Zero. And I stayed through the lunch to listen to Melissa. I'm sorry, I messed up her name. I'm sorry, Melissa, if you're listening.
What other cities are engaged in a Vision Zero initiative right now?
They're Seattle, San Francisco, Chicago, New York City, Washington, D.C. I believe there's others, but those are the ones that come immediately to mind, mm-hmm. With New York City likely being the most successful so far, but they've thrown a ton of resources behind it.
I think read that they had $40 million budgeted for a Vision Zero just in the last fiscal year, just quite a bit. They kind of pinpoint 50 different locations to narrow in on.
Yeah. I mean, it's amazing, and it's really fun to watch and learn from them. Mm-hmm. So
one of the aspects of Vision Zero that they're really going after aggressively is the enforcement aspect. I know that's like the Swedish version is not as heavy on the enforcement. How do you see enforcement working for the Portland Vision Zero?
It's a critical component of the program. We can't have we don't have the resources to have our police officers everywhere throughout the city. We have a fairly small traffic safety division, and they are an exceptional in what they do, but they can't be everywhere all the time. Mm-hmm. So we need additional tools to slow people down. Again, I hope that we can get people to obey posted speed limits, get speed limits lowered through education and encouragement. But at the end of the day, that takes you only so far, and enforcement is the final step in getting behavior change.
Mm-hmm. And I've attended the workshop at the conference where people from the Asian community, Hispanic community, and also Colombia Vila talked about their efforts, and that was very inspiring. One form of transportation that wasn't mentioned was on water. I've heard their plans, as it were, 100 years ago, before some of the bridges were up, to maybe move with barges or canoes or anything going with that. It would be great to see and actually pedal, you know, from one place to another.
There isn't a lot moving on that in terms of water taxi or those kind of systems?
Things like that. Or, you know, like a free service where I could pick up my canoe, on the east side and wind up someplace
else.
I haven't gotten to that. One of the sort of local assets that we have that I don't think we've fully leveraged yet is the Portland Spirit. So the Portland Spirit has a fleet of boats, and they are experts in water traffic and water transport. And we really haven't, we've talked some, and I've talked recently with Dan Yates about this, but he's interested ongoing in seeing a ferry system that would operate between Vancouver and Oregon City, for instance, something like that.
That'd be great. Yeah.
And so it's something that in the sort of coming years, I think is going to be something that will be mentioned within the Central City Plan as something that's a sort of a new element. It's an untapped resource of this space within our city that we could make better use of. So.
Great. I like the canoe. They'll call it Can You Share.
Yes, I can. I love it. Well, and briefly in closing, we were talking about Move by Mike during the during our show halftime. Leah, what did you have a Move by Bike story that you wanted to share?
Yeah, in homage and great inspiration. You know, PBOT, we pride ourselves on being really innovative, and we came out with our Fog Seal program almost 2 years ago for preventative maintenance on our roadway network. And I'm really excited to announce in next fiscal year budget, we're including funding for a new pavement program that's got a triple bottom line in terms of health outcomes, in terms of equipment costs, in terms of carbon footprint. We are going to be implementing Pave by Bike on our neighborhood greenways.
Pave by Bike.
Yeah.
And how would this be initiated?
Every cyclist has to come and
Well,
pave a meter.
It takes about 20 cargo bikes in order to repave a street.
Yeah, and it's going to be
circle the wagons, rally the troops.
Yeah, so hot asphalt will turn to warm asphalt by the time it gets to our roadway. It'll be suitable for any one of our maintenance types.
Well, we look forward to that being rolled out to our neighborhood greenways next year. We will end our April Fool's show on that note. My most sincere thanks to Leah Treat and Art Pierce for joining us today for the KBOO Bike Show. We broadcast live from the KBOO studios in beautiful Portland, Oregon on the first Wednesday of every month. Podcasts are on iTunes, and all past episodes are generously archived at bikeshow.portlandtransport.com. The Bike Show is produced by Alon Robb, Tori Bortman, and myself, Jocelyn Gowdy. We'd like to thank our in-studio engineer, Tammy Dean, our web host, Chris Smith, and our editor, Josh Hetrick. We'll be back next month with more news and views from the cycling world. Until then, make it a great day and keep riding your bike. Thanks so much.
Pedals, two wheels, and a chain. Everybody, ride your bicycle. Let's get together and leave our cars home. Everybody, get on your bicycle. Let's get together to pedal and roam.
Now, this KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from the Garden Spout, specializing in indoor gardening equipment, including horticultural lighting, environmental control, hydroponic and organic ingredients, and pest control. The Garden Spout is located at 4532 Southeast 63rd, just south of Foster in Portland. Information at 503-788-GROW. And you are listening to KBOO Portland. We have a little bit of time before it's the top of the hour. It's about 11:59. And stay tuned now for the KBOO Noon News headlines. After that, they'll hear Jazz Lives. Thanks for tuning in today. Okay, let's try that again.
This is KBOO Headline News at Noon for Wednesday, April 1st, 2015. I'm Diane Erickson.
And I'm Patrick Wilson. In local news, a Portland mother, Tamara Rubin, who is nationally recognized for activism against lead paint hazards, is petitioning Portland schools to eliminate lead hazards in schools built before 1978, the year the U.S. first banned its use. One of her sons was dramatically affected by exposure to lead paint as a child, and in spite of being intellectually gifted, is still impacted by those effects.
The City of Cornelius and the Latino community organization Central Cultural de Washington County are hosting a town hall meeting April 18th to discuss the proposed closure of two public health clinics, one in Hillsborough and one in Beaverton. The Washington County Health and Human Services Department director will explain the closures and answer questions. An interpreter will be present.
In national news, the sentences of 22 drug convicts sent to prison under harsh laws enacted during the early war on drugs were shortened Tuesday by President Obama. This continues a process the president began nearly a year ago. Obama's commutation effort has struggled to take off because of limited resources at the Justice Department office that processes clemency applications.
In spite of the controversy raging in Indiana over legislation passed there that discriminates against gays and lesbians, the Republican-controlled Arkansas state legislature passed the so-called Religious Liberty Law on Tuesday and sent it to their governor for approval. The executive director of the ACLU of Arkansas, which opposes the bill, urged the state legislature and governor of Arkansas to recognize the economic damage and public outcry that Indiana is facing and stop the bill.